You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 30th of October, 2013, on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London with me, Markus Hippi, and Phil Hahn.
Coming up in the next 60 minutes, Shashank Joshi, a fellow at the Royal United Services Institute here in London, will help us to set the day's agenda. Shashank, what are we focusing on today?
We have a real spread. We've got how papers have misunderstood the NSA spying story. We have a piece on Iran border clashes, and we have a piece on how Syria's deputy prime minister has been doing some freelance diplomacy.
More from Shashank a bit later. Plus, Russia's leading opposition figure faces fresh criminal charges. We'll discuss if it is the Kremlin behind the move.
And we'll also head to Silicon Valley for the Robo Business Conference.
I'm 5'3", and I'm a pedestal with a face on it.
Also ahead, who are the future great art and design thinkers? Well, apparently they are all born in 1989 or after.
Ryan Tricantin said once that he believes that people born in the 90s is such an amazing generation, and we just were really curious to find out more about the generation of 89 plus.
More from Hans-Ulrich Obrist, the curator of the 89 Plus Project, in a moment.
All that plus, we're also going to be playing some music here on Midori House. That's all to come in the next hour.
But first, let's catch up on the headlines with Barney Burnham.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Barney Burnham. The head of the US National Security Agency insists it's been acting within legal boundaries amid concern over surveillance of allies. In the last week, there have been claims about widespread monitoring of emails and phone calls in Spain, Italy and France. But the NSA's director, General Keith Alexander, told a hearing with the House of Representatives Intelligence Committee that those claims were false. He poured scorn on the report, saying people who printed and leaked the data didn't understand what they were looking at. And he told the committee that European allies contributed to the surveillance operations.
To be perfectly clear, this is not information that we collected on European citizens. It represents information that we and our NATO allies have collected in defense of our countries and in support of military operations.
Egyptian authorities have detained the senior Muslim Brotherhood leader Essam el-Erian, the latest arrest in a government crackdown against the Islamist movement. Erian, the deputy leader of the Brotherhood's Freedom and Justice Party, was taken into custody from a residence in New Cairo where he'd been in hiding. Egypt television interrupted its early morning programming to announce his arrest. At least 42 people, including several children, have been killed after a luxury private coach caught fire in India's southern Andhra Pradesh state. 49 people were on board the bus, which was travelling from Bangalore to Hyderabad. Officials say the fuel tank appeared to explode after the bus hit the central reservation while trying to overtake another vehicle. The driver was among those who survived the crash. He's now being questioned by police. Excuse me. For the 22nd consecutive year, nearly every member nation of the United Nations General Assembly has voted to condemn the United States' economic embargo against Cuba. 188 nations, including most of Washington's closest allies, voted to support a resolution put forth by Cuba. It calls for an end to the embargo, which has been in effect since 1962. Cuba's minister said it's within President Obama's constitutional authority to change the dynamic between the US and Cuba. But Ronald Goddard, the US delegate to the United Nations, defended the embargo.
The international community cannot in good conscience ignore the ease and frequency with which the Cuban regime silences critics, disrupts peaceful assembly, impedes independent journalism, and despite positive reforms, continues to prevent some Cubans from leaving or returning to the island.
The UN inquiry into human rights violations in North Korea says there's a disturbing pattern of abuses. The UN set up the inquiry in March following pressure by Japan, South Korea, and Western powers in a bid to begin building a case for possible criminal prosecution. The chair of the commission, Michael Kirby, said the preliminary findings were based on testimony from dozens of North Korean exiles. And he said much of what he'd seen and heard was disturbing.
Testimony concerning detention facilities, the lack of proper food in them, the fact that people are in the detention facilities who have committed no offence and no crime according to their testimony.
A city in California has brought a legal action against a food factory because the hot sauce it produces smells too much. Officials in Irwindale, 20 miles from Los Angeles, are demanding that Hui Fong Food should be stopped from making sriracha hot sauce until it does something to reduce the smell. They claim residents of the city have complained of headaches, sore throats and irritated eyes, and that the smell even comes into their homes. Hui Fong, who set up the factory earlier this year, say they're actively trying to fix the problems. The sauce is sold around the world, and a sriracha festival was recently held in Los Angeles. Bon appétit. Those are the main stories here on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much, Barney. If residents were complaining, imagine how insane the conditions must be actually inside the factory.
Well, presumably they'd have to wear gas masks or something, wouldn't they?
They'd be keeled
protective
over.
Clothing.
Yeah, exactly. Thanks very much, Barney. Barney will be back at the bottom of the hour with another check of the world headlines. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
London, Toronto, Tokyo.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London.
Londres, Toronto, Tóquio.
Essa é a Monocle 24.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London. Das ist Monocle 24.
Hong Kong,
Zurich,
London.
Londres. Esto es Monocle 24.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London. Tu vai Monocle, vada se tu cheche.
From London,
London, caralho.
This is Monocle 24.
Welcome back. You're listening to Midori House, live from Studio One here in London. It's time now for us to set the day's agenda with the three stories you'll need to know for the next 24 hours. Well, joining us today in the studio is Shashank Joshi, a senior research fellow at the Royal United Services Institute. Welcome to the program.
Morning.
Shashank, lovely to see you. Shall we begin with the ongoing controversy over the NSA and exactly what they did or perhaps what they didn't do when it came to European allies?
Right. We saw outrage over the past week with French, Spanish leaders summoning US diplomats saying, how could you possibly have hoovered up 60, 70 million phone calls of our citizens? And it's now trickling out, thanks to a particularly good story in the Wall Street Journal, that actually it perhaps wasn't the NSA. It may have been the French and Spanish themselves. And what happened is they seem to be hoovering up data, not on their own citizens, who seem to have been dragged into the story needlessly, but in foreign areas, war zones, crisis areas, and so on, shared the data with the NSA. And the original reporting on this story simply misread the documentation, presumably provided by the leaks from Edward Snowden, the former NSA contractor, and concluded it must have been the Americans. Now, the Americans are in a bit of a bind. They can't push back and say, no, the Europeans did all of this, we didn't, because that would violate long-standing rules on what you can and can't say about what allies are cooperating with you on. It would cause outrage and you would lose these valuable relationships. So it's a great example, I think, first of all, of how limited our understanding is when we see a narrow slice of this data without the context and that applies to all of these revelations, but also, I think, of how Europeans now have to be very careful how they calibrate their level of outrage.
Exactly. Has there been any response from these European officials yet?
There's been resounding silence, but I think it's clear why. They'd be very embarrassed. And I think it shows you this cooperation by which the French and the Spanish, and of course us and everyone else, passes on information to the NSA is really valuable. We get stuff in return and it allows us to pool data, connect patterns and so on, whatever the privacy implications in addition to this. So I think European leaders are more and more aware. They don't want their anger, some of which is manufactured, some of which I think is sincerely held, to get in the way of long-term cooperation. They want to be part of this intelligence sharing in a more cooperative way, not be cut from it.
And yesterday we saw a rather rare appearance from the head of the NSA, Keith Alexander, on Capitol Hill, who was addressing questions with a House committee, saying these allegations were completely false and it's all down to one man, Edward Snowden. And as you mentioned a little earlier, it was the media, perhaps, that misread that information.
Yes.
How much does that discredit Snowden?
It doesn't discredit Snowden. He provided bulk files. I mean, whatever you thought of him, you can still think of him. The issue is how journalists interpret these. What we have got so far, I think it's really important we understand, are briefing notes on many programs. They're not the underlying operational documents that have been written as the programs have been used. This doesn't tell you everything you need to know. It doesn't tell you how they're implemented in practice. It doesn't tell you the tacit rules that govern their use. So all of that is still really an incomplete picture.
So how dangerous is it then with journalists from Der Spiegel or Le Monde or The Guardian just taking in Snowden's material without really doing the proper background research or analysis of it?
I think they have to make sure they speak to US officials and they have to make sure they know all they can. However, I should also say, none of this is to discredit the real stories. It still seems clear to me the US did spy on Chancellor Merkel's phone and that Obama probably didn't know about it, although someone else in the White House might have done. And that is still, I think, in my opinion, I'm not as jaded and as cynical as everyone else, quite a serious story, I think.
Shashank, shall we move on to Iran next? There's been clashes, violence in Iran close to the border with Pakistan. The latest is that Iranian security forces have killed four members of a clan of an extremist rebel group.
And this comes on the heels of a major attack on border guards for which Iran retaliated by hanging a number of prisoners. Why does this matter? Well, it matters because I think this should be seen as part of a potential Saudi-Iranian proxy war in the region. We know elements of that war in Syria, perhaps in Yemen, in the Gulf itself. I'd like to just bring our attention to Pakistan and say it stretches as far east as this. The group that did this killing was called Jesh-ul-Adl. It's a Sunni group. In the past, other Sunni groups have attacked Iran in response to its poor treatment of its own Sunni minority. Iran, of course, is a Shia majority state, and also what they see as Iran's depredations against Sunni Muslims inside Syria. But it's possible, and Iran has alleged, Iran state agencies have said, Saudi Arabia has provided backing for this. Would I put it past Saudi Arabia to give Iran a bloody nose on its own backyard? Not at all. We've seen it in the past within Pakistan. I think we could see it again on the border here.
Do you think there's wider Sunni cooperation of these rebel groups across the region?
Well, no. I mean, of course,
or do you think it's strictly just down to Saudi Arabia, perhaps?
Or indigenous. Because, of course, in the past, we've seen Baloch groups, local ethnic Baloch groups who are part of Iran's Balochistan province, which neighbors the huge Pakistani Balochistan province, fighting for their ethnic rights or separatist causes. So it doesn't have to be either Sunni cooperation across the region in a sort of Al-Qaeda alliance or jihadist alliance, and it doesn't have to be Saudi Arabian puppeteers pulling the strings. It could be an indigenous group with genuine grievances against Iran being given the occasional bag of cash by a Saudi intelligence officer in Karachi or something.
Shashank, story number three for this day is from Syria. Syrian President Bashar al-Assad's regime has fired its deputy prime minister.
Yes, and it appears he was engaged in some very unorthodox freelance diplomacy. He not only met the former US ambassador to Syria, Robert Ford, in Geneva on Saturday, so a few days ago, to hammer out some ideas about the peace talks coming up next month, the so-called Geneva II. It appears it also says, one official, he tried to win US backing to include him on the opposition side in the Geneva talks. This is fascinating. Jamil was one of the first officials a few weeks ago to say in a Guardian interview that the war was in stalemate. No official had said that before.
What's the deeper story behind this? Do you think there potentially are signs that Bashar al-Assad's government or inner circle perhaps are starting to crumble, people going in their own direction, trying to forge new deals behind his back?
I think there's two options. One of them is you're seeing, as you say, a splintering of the regime, people freelancing, doing their own thing. We'll see more of this possibly. I think what's more likely is we're in a strange situation where the regime as a whole wants peace talks more than everyone else now because they think they're winning. They don't think the other side will seriously deliver, so they have little to lose. The opposition looks like the bad guys when they say they won't turn up. So actually, the regime itself is sort of keen on peace talks. What it doesn't want, of course, is officials going off and cutting these deals behind their backs.
How much do we know? Did he actually achieve anything when he was visiting Switzerland?
We know nothing, actually. Remarkably little, other than that he's been sacked. He was a bit of a thorn in the Assad regime's side before then, too. But what I think is really, really interesting is that Geneva 2 is looking like a disaster. I'm sure we'll come back and talk about this in a few weeks' time. Mm-hmm. But actually, it's difficult for me to see how any major armed group is going to turn up at the table. So if the Syrian regime did turn up, it would be a propaganda coup. In our side, we'd look like the baddies.
Shashank, unfortunately, we're going to have to leave it there. Shashank Joshi, Senior Research Fellow at the Royal United Services Institute here in London. Thanks very much for coming in.
No problem.
Coming up, we'll find out why Russia's leading opposition figure is back in the news.
Architecture is a powerful way to brand a place, but not without risk in a location rich in tradition and natural beauty. Monocle Films journeyed to the remote island of Fogo in Newfoundland to experience Todd Saunders' iconic artist studios and Travellers Inn.
Architecture is a tool, it's a language, and if done well, it can be a servant of place and people. And I think Todd does that. The studios are like little punctuation marks on the landscape that hold your attention. And a focus like that is a kind of a devotion, really, to the landscape.
Cultural resilience through architecture, now playing in the film's menu on monocle.com.
Welcome back to Midori House. The time is 12:16 in Moscow. It is 9:16 in Milan and 8:16 here in London. Alexei Navalny has been Russia's leading opposition figure and stunned political onlookers with a strong showing in recent mayoral elections in Moscow. But pressure from the Kremlin has been piling on Navalny, most recently with his conviction for theft. He was found guilty and sentenced to a 5-year prison term. Last month, that sentence was suspended.
But in a move that will anger Russia's opposition movement, investigators have announced fresh theft and money laundering charges on Navalny. If he is found guilty, he could be sentenced to 10 years in prison. So, do these new charges have any validity, or is it purely the Kremlin playing politics? Well, joining us now on the line from Moscow is a regular Monocle contributor, Joshua Yaffa. Josh, fresh charges against Navalny and also his brother.
That's right. In a way, they're fresh, and that, as you pointed out, they were officially filed against Navalny and his brother yesterday. But in another way, these go back to a wave of legal harassment and intimidation against Navalny that began to pick up speed in the spring and summer of 2012, in fact. That's when the investigative committee, the main investigative arm in Russia that has become something of the kind of political police or attack dog of the Kremlin in its ongoing battle for power with the opposition, launched all manner of investigations into Navalny. One of them was reopening an older case that resulted in the charges and sentence you just mentioned, this 5-year suspended sentence. But there are about half a dozen investigations launched on all manner of activities supposedly relating to Navalny's various criminal dealings in one sphere or another. And then those investigations hemmed and hawed and became active and less active over the past year and a half. And what it seems like is that now the authorities will use these ongoing, technically still open investigations as a kind of sword of Damocles over Navalny. They can always be sped up, they can always be activated, and as we saw yesterday, they can always then be filed as criminal charges.
Do these new charges have any validity whatsoever?
It's hard to say. It certainly seems very much like they're politically motivated charges. Again, I said this investigation was launched at the same time as about a half a dozen other investigations that all appeared within a span of a few weeks or months against Navalny, just as his political activity was picking up momentum. It certainly seems like these charges, as well as all the others, are part of a general campaign of intimidation, harassment, sort of putting Navalny in his place, if you will, and also essentially just tying him up from keeping him doing his political and anti-corruption work. Already with all of these multiple investigations, the trial in Kirov last spring and summer, perhaps a new trial related to these charges, he simply kept quite busy running from one court and police and investigation office to another.
Well, do you really think that this will tie Navalny up to pursue, you know, his anti-corruption movement and his opposition movement? Because even though he was in Kirov for those charges last spring, he still was able to run in Moscow's mayor election and did surprisingly well.
That's right. It doesn't seem like if the goal here is to intimidate Navalny into silence or to keep him so busy and under such constant harassment that he simply doesn't have the opportunity to pursue his political work. I think all of that, certainly, as we've seen and as you pointed out in the Kirov trial, that effect has not been achieved, if indeed that was what the authorities hoped. To bring about. If anything, this constant legal pressure and harassment seems to galvanize Navalny. He seems to get a certain kind of inspiration or energy, even if you will, from it. There also, we should point out that the authorities are not monolithic. Much of this, this campaign of legal harassment may be coming from the investigative committee itself, a very hard-line law enforcement agency whose head, Alexander Bastrykhin, is known to be a conservative who favors tougher repressive measures against the opposition. So it could be the investigative committee's play for power influence inside the governing system. And not all members of that governing system necessarily agree with their methods.
Has Navalny said anything about these latest charges himself?
Yes, he's described them as absurd, as a part of an attempt to, quote, terrorize those who go against the state and the authorities. He says he sort of understands the logic of the charges as being part of this campaign of intimidation. What's most curious is we haven't yet heard from the French cosmetics firm Yves Rocher. They are linked up in the case in that the Navalny brothers are accused of essentially defrauding the Russian branch of Yves Rocher in a contract relating to cargo delivery. So as the kind of victim, if you will, in this case, I think it would be very interesting to hear what this French multinational cosmetics company has to say about being caught up in this case.
Monocle's Joshua Yaffa in Moscow, thank you very much for this.
All around the world, Monocle 24's growing network of correspondents bring you the latest news, reportage and insight from New York to Nairobi, Bamako to Berlin.
For Monocle in Paris, I'm Tom Burgess-Watson.
For Monocle in Berlin, I'm Kimberly Bradley.
For Monocle in Pristina.
In New York.
In Cairo.
In Sao Paulo.
I'm Guy Delaunay. From Monaco.
From Monaco.
In Tel Aviv.
From Monaco.
In San Francisco.
In North Vancouver.
In Ramallah.
I'm Aisha Spears.
I'm Joseph Dane.
From Monaco. I'm Sheena Rossiter.
In Bogota.
In London.
Bangkok.
Buenos Aires.
So, whether you want to know what's happening in the corridors of power, in the boardrooms of the aviation giants, or the must-sees at the latest film festival, stay tuned to Monocle 24. Monocle 24, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
Welcome back to Midori House. The time is 10:23 in Istanbul. It's 8:23 here in London. And we are headed to Turkey next to check in with our Eastern Mediterranean correspondent, Joseph Dana. Joseph, welcome to the program. We were covering yesterday Republic Day here on Monocle 24, but you were there in Istanbul and you actually saw a bit of violence. What's the latest on the situation?
Well, I did in fact see a bit of violence, but it wasn't the amount of violence that some in Turkey, or at least in Istanbul, feared. There were some mild clashes around Istiklal and Taksim Square, so a number of the Gezi Park protesters kind of tried to rekindle some of the flame of their summer revolution, but it didn't really end like they wanted to, and we didn't see massive violence across Turkey. In fact, it was a very jovial day, and there's a very nice fireworks display across the Bosphorus last night, which was somewhat of a treat.
And Joseph, if we continue with other topics today, I can't help finding the following story slightly amusing. The big discussion topic, is yoga acceptable for Turks?
Yeah, it's a fantastic story, but it does reflect still that tension between secularism and religiosity in modern Turkey. Basically, the Interior Ministry here in Turkey sought the advice of the Directorate of Religious Affairs, which is also a state institution, about whether or not yoga is permitted in Islam. Now, the funny thing is that the Interior Ministry wants to offer yoga services or classes for some of the overstressed police force here in Turkey. Clearly, a lot of these police officers are quite exhausted after the summer of protests, and so the Interior Ministry is kind of trying to find some new ways to provide some relaxation for them. And it sparked a very interesting debate in the Turkish papers as to, you know, whether or not yoga is permissible and whether or not we should even be kind of talking about this in Turkey. And again, it strikes that very interesting line between kind of secular Turkey and religious Turkey. And so we have basically two state institutions talking about whether or not yoga is in fact permissible by Islam.
And do we have a sense in terms of which way this debate is going to go? Are the overstressed police yogis going to win?
Well, I would say I think there's many police officers that would enjoy some yoga classes provided by the state. But what you have is in Istanbul, yoga is very, very popular. In fact, right next to my flat, there's two yoga studios. And so you have it very, you know, yoga is a very big deal in the secular community. And increasingly, or at least this is what we saw debated in the Turkish press, a number of kind of religious Muslims actually trying to, you know, start doing some yoga as well. And so, again, we have that tension. You don't really see in Cairo or in other, you know, kind of Arab cities around the region a lot of religious Muslims doing yoga. But in Istanbul and in Turkey, this is something that is increasingly common.
And Joseph, last week you were in Egypt reporting for Monocle 24, and your next story is actually from there. The liberal political party formed by Mohamed El Baradei has suffered yet another mass resignation.
Absolutely. Mohamed El Baradei, who is known as really the kind of atypical Egyptian liberal, suffered a very big defeat on Sunday in which 11 members of his Constitution Party basically walked out on him. Now, this is an incredibly important event because of the timing. November is promising to be a very, very dramatic month in Cairo. Specifically, we have the trial of Mohamed Morsi that's supposed to start in the beginning of November. There's still some Mubarak trials that are planned. And then at the end of the month, we're expecting the constitution referendum, which is going to be a huge debate in Egyptian society as to where the country is going. Is it going more Islamic? Is it going to root out these kind of Islamic trends, especially from the Muslim Brotherhood? Or is it going to go back to its kind of very strange strange dance with liberalism? And so Mohamed El Baradei really wants to be placed in the middle of that discussion, but members of his own party clearly don't feel as though he has the leadership. And then again, it goes back to that incredible tension as to where Egypt is going. The debates in Egyptian society right now are very confused and very frightened, actually, in which a number of liberals who have supported the removal of Morsi by the military still don't know how to reconcile that support with liberal values. And apparently El Baradei's voice, or at least his path of bringing this sort of Western liberalism to Egyptian society, doesn't appear to be working, at least if we take the fellow members of his party at their word.
And the streets of Cairo have been relatively quiet in the last few weeks from protests. When the trial of Mohamed Morsi does begin, could we expect violent protests from the Muslim Brotherhood?
I think that's a very likely scenario. The streets have been quiet, but there has been a military curfew in place. And so the streets are quiet because you see a number of APCs around, you see a number of tanks. The military's presence is ever present in Cairo at this moment, and they are going to be clearly ready for any sort of confrontation with the Muslim Brotherhood. Now, Mohamed Morsi has already, you know, decried the trial as being ludicrous and not valid, and so the Muslim Brotherhood is faced with a very interesting kind of paradigm here in which it could really push its members onto the streets and force a certain confrontation with the state, or it can kind of go back to the, you know, more underground Muslim Brotherhood that we've known from the past 80 years and let this trial kind of play through. I have a feeling that this trial is going to be very, very long in the coming, and it's going to take a very long time to actually get anywhere. But violence, sadly, in Egyptian society at this moment is a certain reality that we can't avoid.
Staying in the region, moving from Egypt to Israel. Israel is said to be building one of the world's largest solar power plants. How important would this power plant be for Israel?
I think that this is one of the real stories to watch in the region right now. Israel is sitting on a huge amount of natural gas, which we've talked a lot about on Monocle 24, and it is about to become a real energy broker. So it's very interesting that we have news last week that the Israelis are going to build a billion-dollar solar power plant in the desert, the fifth largest type plant in the world, in order to start weaning off of traditional energy sources in favor of renewable energy sources for Israeli society. And so they're projecting that roughly 10% of their power will come from renewable sources by 2020. And I think that this is a real sign that they want to have a certain energy independence while sitting on a lot of energy reserves that they can export, whether that is to Greece or to Turkey or even to Jordan. And so the Israelis in the next couple of months and certainly in the next couple of years are going to become real energy players in this very energy-rich region, and that's going to change the geopolitics of the Middle East for many years to come.
That was our man in Istanbul, Joseph Dana. Thank you very much.
And in the next half hour of the program, we'll meet a man who has set out to discover the next generation of art and design visionaries. And we're also going to be heading to the Robo Business Conference in Santa Clara.
Traditionally, it's been the automotive industry that has been the biggest driver. We're seeing big progress in the healthcare sector. So I think we're moving away from the traditional factories into doing healthcare support.
So a very busy second half of the program. But before all that, here's Barney Burnham with the news headlines.
Thanks, Phil. The head of the U.S. National Security Agency insists it's been acting within legal boundaries amid concern over surveillance of allies. General Keith Alexander told the House of Representatives Intelligence Committee that claims of widespread monitoring of emails and phone calls in Spain, Italy and France were false. Egyptian authorities have detained the senior Muslim Brotherhood leader Essam el-Erian, the latest arrest in a government crackdown against the Islamist movement. Erian, the deputy leader of the Brotherhood's Freedom and Justice Party, was taken into custody from a residence in New Cairo where he'd been in hiding. At least 42 people, including several children, have been killed after a luxury private coach caught fire in India's southern Andhra Pradesh state. Officials say the fuel tank appeared to explode after the bus hit the central reservation while trying to overtake another vehicle. For the 22nd consecutive year, nearly every member nation of the UN General Assembly has voted to condemn the United States' economic embargo against Cuba. 188 nations voted to support a resolution put forth by Cuba which calls for an end to the embargo, which has been in place since 1962. The UN inquiry into human rights violations in North Korea says there's a disturbing pattern of abuses. Chair of the Commission, Michael Kirby, said the preliminary findings, based on testimony from dozens of North Korean exiles, had included disturbing material. A city in California has brought a legal action against a food factory because the hot sauce it produces smells too much. Officials in Irwindale, 20 miles from Los Angeles, are demanding that Hui Fong Food should be stopped from making sriracha hot sauce until it does something to reduce the smell. Those are the headlines at the bottom of the hour here on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much, Barney. You're back with Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Phil Hahn, and Marcus Hippie. It is 8:33 here in London. Now, this week on The Entrepreneurs, we'll take a look at the future of startups in Africa. We'll be visiting a guillotine shop in Spain and also chat with a Mexican promoting British menswear in London. But in this preview of the show, we're off to the United States.
Silicon Valley is a hotbed of technology research and development, but a major question for the robotics industry is how to take that sophisticated research and turn it into devices that sell like hotcakes. Monocle's San Francisco correspondent Alistair G reports from the Robo Business Conference on attempts to find a mass market for robots.
I'm 5'3", and I'm a pedestal with a face on it.
In a conference center in Silicon Valley, a woman identified only as Brianna is trundling around and saying hello to visitors. As she says, she looks a bit, well, different. The real Brianna is sat in an office building a few miles away, but a video image of her face is being broadcast to a screen atop a pedestal at the conference, and because the pedestal has wheels, she is able to control it remotely and travel through the building as though she were really here. It's a robotic twist on teleconferencing.
If you have headquarters or an office that you want to check out, speak to some of your employees. You can walk around, you can greet them, you can go into their offices and have real-time conversations with them and, you know, grab a cup of coffee in the break room with them.
This conference is devoted to robotics. Not the technology, though, but the business. And the question everyone here is asking is this. We have sophisticated machines that can operate autonomously, more or less. So how do we get people to use them more often? Increasingly, it seems, for robots to become more a part of our lives, the challenge is to do with their economics. Take Brianna and her robotic teleconferencing device, known as a Beam.
We haven't sold enough yet, so we're still expanding. We launched this product back in November. Yeah, we're looking for more customers.
As Scott Hassan, president of the company that makes the Beam, tells it, getting people to adopt robots is less an issue of the technology not being ready or people not accepting them than of something much more mundane.
People already have ways of doing things that are working for them, and so thus adding a robot is more complicated for them to do, you know, whatever process they want to do.
In particular, Hassan says, one of the most important factors is the economics of robots. The starting price for a Beam is $16,000. He and other manufacturers have to convince potential customers that robots such as the Beam offer a cost saving over other, more humdrum solutions.
You know, you can talk about the travel budgets of people, and that's what we're talking to the government about, right? Like, they have a lot of budget constraints on their travel budgets, and so we quantify them, like, if you do this so many trips a year to different locations, that pays for a Beam in no time.
Industrial robots, often meaning fixed robotic arms, are becoming staples in the electronics and auto industries. But outside of that, autonomous or semi-autonomous machines that perform services for humans are relatively rare. According to the International Federation for Robotics, only 126,000 such service robots have been sold for professional use since 1998. Two areas, however, seem like a natural fit for robots. Agriculture and healthcare. And that's partly because robots are economically viable in those industries.
We see a shift away from traditional manufacturing to services. Traditionally, it's been the automotive industry that has been the biggest driver. We're seeing big progress in the healthcare sector. So I think we're moving away from the traditional factories into doing healthcare support. So having people assisted in their daily life as we get an aging society.
That's Henrik Christensen, a robotics professor and the chair of the US National Robotics Roadmap Project. Robots have indeed already made it into one Silicon Valley hospital.
Just under 1 million square feet of space on the campus, and we deploy the robots to all of those buildings.
Ken King is Chief Administrative Services Officer at El Camino Hospital. When the hospital moved into a new, larger space, it found it had a problem. Departments were requesting more staff to deal with all the extra coming and going, so the hospital found it was actually cheaper, at around 50% of the cost, to bring in 19 autonomous robots that would transport food and samples down the long corridors. King agrees that human jobs are lost as a result, but says that the benefits outweigh that.
Well, certainly if we didn't have the robots, we would have to have staff doing them. But we also know, particularly in this country, that the demand for decreasing the cost of healthcare. And there is an obligation that we have to our community and to the community we serve to bring those costs down.
That cost argument may find traction in agriculture as well, says Brandon Baso, a senior engineer at 3D Robotics. He suggests that as a group, farmers are not naturally inclined to shift to robotic technology.
If you're dealing with someone like a farmer, they don't necessarily want to change what they're doing because they've been doing it for a while and it works. So you have a real kind of social problem. You have to sell people on the idea. I think people are a little bit distrustful of autonomy because they don't understand what it could do for them, how it will work.
So Bezos says that his company and others like it are pointing out the financial benefits of robots. For example, airborne drones can take photographs of a property, making farmers quickly aware of any problems with their crops and allowing them to target the issue with geographic precision. And that means savings.
Every week, you're going to be able to detect pests. So you can spray zero pesticide, potentially, and then you're going to selectively spray in areas that require it.
Back on the expo floor, robotic arms whir and twist. The technology is impressive, but as attendees at this conference attest, one of the next big challenges for the industry is convincing people that robots will save them a dollar or two. For Monocle in Silicon Valley, I'm Alistair G.
And you can catch more business reports from around the world on the brand new episode of The Entrepreneurs, which premieres at 1900 hours London time. That is at 8 a.m. in Auckland and midday in San Francisco.
You're listening to Midori House. After this, we'll meet a curator who has started collecting the next generation of thinkers. Stay tuned.
The Monocle app has all the details of what's coming up on Monocle 24 and offers you the chance to catch up on the shows you might have missed. You can download programs to your mobile or tablet to listen offline and set reminders for all your favourites. It also has one-tap access to the latest news reports from our editors and correspondents around the world. The 2525 is Monocle's insider guide to the world's premier resort and business cities. The app features recommendations for the best hotels, restaurants, and retail opportunities, along with GPS directions, ensuring Monocle is your one-stop guide to city hopping. You can even give us feedback on personal favourites you've discovered on your travels. The Monocolumn is Instapaper supported and available to read on your mobile, fully integrated to fit any size and screen. The Monocle app is available through iTunes and at monocle.com. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
Welcome back. You're listening to Midori House. The time is 16:41 in Kuala Lumpur. It's 8:41 here in London. Now, who will be the next generation of art and design visionaries? Well, that's the question. One of the most influential people in the art world, Hans-Ulrich Obrist and Simon Kastis, the director of the Swiss Institute in New York, are trying to answer with their 89-plus project.
Obrist and Kastis have set out to collect the next generation of thinkers and gather them to run residencies and talks around the world. Only one rule applies. The lucky 89ers must indeed have been born in 1989 or after. In case you find the date somewhat arbitrary, that is, among other things, the year the internet was invented and the Cold War ended. Kimberly Bradley, Monocle's Berlin correspondent, went along to the first 89 plus workshop in Zurich, and she joins us now on the line to tell us more. Kimberly, when you went to see that workshop, what exactly was going on over there?
Well, I could tell you the workshop was a bit private. There were 10 89ers that had been selected by Obrist and Kastetz, and they met up with some local people from Zurich and workshopped in the morning, but there was a panel in the afternoon where a selected group of maybe maximum 50 people listened to the presentations, which were very interesting. They were kicked off, actually, by a keynote speech by very famous Swiss economist Hans-Christoph Binswanger. And the theme was resources. It's like, how does this new generation deal with resources? Each of these workshops deals with one theme. And then we listen to each person talk about how their practice deals with resources, range from designers and novelists, Chibundu Onuzo, who's Nigerian and lives in London, Josh Batelli, who also lives in London, who creates amazing pieces out of asphalt, for example. And it was very fascinating to see people that young who are pushing the envelope that far.
Kimberly, what's the long-term plan then for the 89-plus project?
Hans-Ulrich and Simon have already done a couple of things. They did an architectural workshop in New York in the summer and an 89-plus interview marathon at the Serpentine a couple of weeks ago. He's quite famous for doing these interview marathons, but in the future, there will be more workshops like this that will be small, but there's an exhibition coming up in Switzerland in January. They will be at the Arco Art Fair in Madrid. They have a big project coming up in Mexico. So every couple months, somewhere in the world, they'll partner with a local organization, present a few people from other parts of the world, but also create some sort of dialogue with what's going on locally with young people.
And Kimberly, you actually had the chance to catch up with Hans-Ulrich Obrister. Let's take a listen to that interview now.
89 Plus is a project which Simon Castel and I started about 4 years ago when we met first in Yokohama and then intensified the research about a year ago, where we felt that it would be interesting and also urgent to find out what the first digital native generation of artists, artists born in 89 and younger, are doing, what's the direction of their work taking. I mean, Ryan Trecartin said once that he believes that people born in the 90s is such an amazing generation, and we just were really curious to find out more about the generation of 89 plus. 89 is the year, of course, the wall came down. 89 is also the year of Tiananmen Square, but 89 is the year also where Tim Berners-Lee invented the internet. So we wanted to start a global research. It was first presented at DLD in Munich and then developed into a research platform. We have more than 2,000 dossiers and information on artists uploaded so far. We can obviously now start to see first patterns emerge. And it's something which we really feel is a long-term, long-durational project. So it's going to last 10 or 20 years. So it's still early days.
So essentially you asked young people born after 89 to upload what they do onto your platform. I just want to get the nuts and bolts as to how you access these people. They seem to be coming to you and up through recommendation. If you could describe how this group evolves.
Yes, I mean, this is a very interesting question because on the one hand, people come to us and at the same time, we find artists. So as the project is discussed, as there is a lot of things online, we have artists now from all over the world who upload, and that's obviously relevant because it means that also artists who are not part of a network, artists who are not part of the art world yet, have this possibility to upload and show us their work. Yet at the same time, we also very actively, you know, research, we are very actively, you know, make studio visits. We ask a lot of artists to teach, to recommend artists for us. When we started the research for Zurich, we felt it's important to connect to the local scene here in Switzerland. So many people recommended artists, and the artist Peter Fischli, who now also teaches at the Städelschule, recommended a young Swiss artist, Bernhard Heglin, who then performed here yesterday. And that's a little bit part of the methodology. Very often artists know best where the new generation of artists are. But also we want this to be beyond the art world. We think it's important that it's also, you know, activism. There's an amazing new generation of activism. Internet changes completely the way that, you know, activism sort of functions. And the other day, you know, we came across Joshua Wong, who is a teenager in Hong Kong, who stages via social media demonstrations and gatherings of hundreds of thousands of teenagers who protest against the homogenization of the Chinese curriculum in Hong Kong. So it's art, it's activism, but it's also poetry, literature, music. It's a very, very transdisciplinary project.
With 89 plus in a way, are you defining, putting a number on a generation just like in Europe you have the 68ers? Is that in a way what you're doing?
We felt from the very beginning that it would be too limiting to kind of freeze the idea of that generation, you know, into a sort of a frozen definition. We wanted there to be a parameter, you know, and we felt that 89 as a year was an interesting parameter because it really is the beginning of the digital age. And we wanted to research and investigate what that means for all the different art forms and for society. We then, very early on in the research, spoke to Douglas Copeland, the Canadian author who is an expert in defining generations because he had defined already the Generation X and many subsequent generations. And Douglas almost immediately came up with this definition of the Diamond Generation. And the Diamond Generation, because of its sharpness and its transparency, but in conversation with him, we felt, you know, we wouldn't want to give a definition of that generation a priori. It's for this generation to define themselves. We do not want to, from, you know, outside, define it. We want to create a platform where these voices can be heard and where they can be encountered. And then, you know, we listen, we look and look and look again and start to see these emerging patterns. Another thing which is emerging now, which we find very fascinating, is this research of an interest in poetry. Throughout the 20th century, at all times when there were moments of avant-garde, if it's the early 20s, and we were here in Zurich, the birthplace of Dada, we are very near the Cabaret Voltaire, and it's interesting to think that all these historic avant-gardes, Dada totally was all about poetry, surrealism. Again, many of the artists were both visual artists and poets. Many of the poets were involved with the artists. And even the neo avant-garde of the 60s, still with Fluxus, we have this strong connection to poetry. Emmett Williams was as much a poet as he was a visual artist. And so I think in our time, poetry maybe is not only less present in society, but also the art world has somehow lost the touch with poetry. And I find it very fascinating how through the internet, a completely new generation finds a completely new form of poetry, and how this whole new generation of poetry now, you know, appears, emerges, and that will be definitely something which we will, you know, further explore, the sort of sound of the spoken word, also the connection also between poetry and architecture. For us, rather than to define a generation, we want to learn from that generation, we want to look, we want to listen, and we want to sort of locate more of these emerging patterns, you know, from our research and do many exhibitions, conferences, residencies over the next couple of years.
And that was Hans Ulrich Obrist, the curator of the 89 Plus Project, speaking to our Berlin correspondent, Kimberly Bradley. Now the first 89 Plus art exhibition, curated by Obrist and Castes, opens in the Luma Westbau space at the Löwenbräu Complex in Zurich on the 30th of January of next year.
In a moment, we'll leave through the European front pages, but first it's time for a bit of music. And given the Francophile twist of the upcoming newspaper review, let's play a singer that's doing really well in the French capital. This is Papa Outai by Stromae.
Dites-moi d'où il vient, enfin je saurai où je vais. Maman dit que lorsqu'on cherche bien, on finit toujours par trouver. Elle dit qu'il n'est jamais très loin. C'est de son pouce ou quoi? Dites-nous où c'est caché. Ça doit faire au moins mille fois qu'on a bouffé nos doigts. Hey, où t'es, papa?
That was Papa Outai by Stromae here on Monocle 24.
And you are indeed listening to Midori House with me, Phil Hahn, and Marcus Hippie. We're now joined in the studio by Monocle researcher Alexa Firmanich. Welcome to the program, Alexa.
Good morning, Phil.
Did you enjoy our second anniversary party last night?
I had a great time.
Not yourself? Too worse for wear today?
Getting there slowly.
Okay. Well, where should we begin, though, with one of the papers this morning?
Well, we can start with Le Monde, where yesterday the French government decided to suspend an eco-tax that it had proposed to put into place in the beginning of next year. Over the weekend in Brittany, there were huge protests. Basically, this eco-tax is aimed at encouraging eco-friendly vehicles. So it would have levied a tax on heavy vehicles transporting over 3.5 tons of commercial goods. And what happened is over the weekend in Brittany, there were huge protests. People were lighting bales of hay and tires, throwing them on fire, throwing exit police. It was a bit of a strange alliance between different groups in the region, but they all mobilized behind this. Because basically Brittany is a very heavy farming region, and they rely a lot on their roads for transport because they don't have very good rail links. And so they're saying that the tax would really, really damage their already precarious farming.
Well, an unfortunate financial fact is that France needs about 3 billion euros in tax increases next year. Where else is the money going to come from then?
I mean, that's the huge debate, because if this tax doesn't go into place, it's going to cost them around 800 million euros. And the big debate in France is basically the politicians are losing a lot of their clout and a lot of their authorities. This is the second time in the past few days that they've tried to put a tax into place and it's been repealed. So they're doing all these fiscal U-turns, and a lot of people are just getting very fed up with the politicians, and they're saying, you know, our politicians are paralyzed. How are they going to regain the power and be able to put taxes into place? Because everything they do just meets with opposition.
And of course, this part of France is very important when it comes to trade between the UK and France. Lots of the products and goods get transported through ferries, don't they? So if they're taxing these foreign vehicles, how could that potentially damage?
I mean, I think it's just a huge damage to the region in general, and a lot of the factories are already going out of business in the area, so it's just going to be another economic blow to France.
And moving on to your second story, it's kind of a historical story, isn't it?
Yeah, this is from the Tribune de Genève. So Rome has these very famous aqueducts, which is sort of one of the greatest archaeological feats of all time. They used to supply the entire city of Rome with so much water. I mean, at one point, you'd have over 2,000 liters of water per second just using gravity. So in these tunnels carved into the rocks and mountains. And actually, they've never been properly mapped. It was started last century by this British archaeologist, but never really completed. So now what they're doing is they're going in with lasers, 3D scanners and robots, and they're essentially just mapping all of these kilometers of aqueducts.
And do we know what they're going to do with these maps, so to speak?
They haven't actually really said. I think it's just more of a case of, you know, mapping the history of a city and all of these tunnels going under the city. And it's actually, there's also quite a cute story. There's these old men who have gotten together, and they're called the Volunteers of the Park of the Aqueducts. Mm. And they've sort of tried to clear out a lot of the aqueducts that are above the ground. They've fallen into disrepair, and they've pruned them, and they've put running parks through, and they're trying to maintain this heritage.
And there's only one aqueduct that's still in use, is that right?
Yeah, and it ends up, a part of it, in the very famous Trevi Fountain.
And moving on to Spain, it looks like in Catalonia, the future of circuses is going to be slightly different from what people have got used to.
They're trying to ban on animals, all animals from circuses, a bit of a Cirque du Soleil move.
Then what's going to be in the circus?
Good question.
So what is this proposition?
Well, basically yesterday, a majority in Parliament, they passed a proposition to ban all use of animals because of human rights pressures, saying the animals get mistreated behind the scenes. And I mean, this is already a huge trend in Spain and in many countries. It started in Bolivia with Morales back in 2009. And now it's just, it's going to be passed, basically. I mean, it's a majority rule, and not that many circuses already still use animals, so.
I think there's kind of a delicate balance when you think that, you know, not necessarily all the animals in circuses are suffering and so on. And at the same time, we do have animals in zoos.
Exactly. But the animals in zoos are stationary, and they're not made to jump through hoops, and they're not, you know, made to fight fire and stuff. But also, it's interesting because in Catalan, you also have the whole issue of the bullfighting. Mm. So they have this very strong sort of animal protection movement.
But a lot of people, obviously, I'm guessing, are quite angry at this move because this is part of their traditions, isn't it?
I think the bullfighting
so bull
a lot more.
Maybe
yeah,
not on the circus.
It has a lot of popular support through society. So no more seals, no more horses.
Do you think many people are going to be missing them in Catalonia?
I would miss them.
Well, thanks very much, Alexa, for coming in and having a look at some of the stories, the big stories for today. Really appreciate it. It is just coming up to 9 o'clock here in London, which means it is fast approaching the end of our program. Many thanks to our producer, Daphne Denny, our researcher, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and of course, our lovely researcher, Harriet Thorpe, as well. And of course, our studio manager, Alex Funnell. Up next, after the news, is The Menu with Monocle's very own Marcus Hippie. Very excited.
Very, very much coming up in that program, actually. We are going to head to Copenhagen to find out about the future of new Nordic cuisine, for example. And we also speak to one of the best French chefs in London, Pierre Kaufman, who's going to deliver about his project that involves a lot of crepes.
Sounds delicious. Well, stay tuned for the briefing at midday London time, 8 o'clock in New York. I'll be back with Georgina Godwin for Midori House at the same time tomorrow. But for now, from me, Phil Hahn.
And from me, Marco Sippi. Thank you for listening and goodbye.
Why this watch? This watch is a witness to words that moved nations. It's dared men faster, further. It's been worn by luminaries, visionaries, champions. It doesn't just tell time, it tells history. Rolex.